columns and videos delivered to your inbox every morning. Register for the free Denver Sports Daily at 1043thefan.com.
Go to 1043thefan.com and subscribe to The Fan Daily for the latest columns, blogs, news, videos, and more sent directly to your inbox every weekday morning.
Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan presents Football at 4. Steelers Week. Breaking down the game between the Broncos and Steelers on this Think Big Thursday. Here's The Drive with Tyler Palumbus and D-Mac.
This might set up to be one of the more difficult games of the year for the Broncos. I saw Mike Bliss put it out there, Tyler, that the Broncos are 5.5-point underdogs already for this particular game. By the way, they're favored against the Titans. With the exception of Orlando and Cecil, everybody on the big board of predictions, the other 10 hosts on the show, have the Broncos losing to the Steelers. So maybe I'll just start there. And when we think big about winning, perhaps how we can correct it. But to start, why do you think it's so imposing to play the Steelers on the road?
Well, it's just one of those games that you look at and you say, well, they got the terrible towels. They've got the tradition. They've got Ben Roethlisberger. They've got Mike Tomlin. It's a historically really good football team. Very few times do you ever play the Pittsburgh Steelers and feel like that's a matchup that you're going to be favored in. And then on top of that, you talk about Drew Lock, second game of the season, going on the road, very intimidating environment, all those sorts of things. And it just adds up to feeling like it's a tough ask for him. It's a really tough ask for him.
Well,
I do find myself kind of fluctuating a little bit on my opinion of it, though. What is Big Ben going to be? Who is he? And how healthy is he? Is he going to come back and continue to play at a high level? I say yes. For now, I assume that he's going to come back and be at peak performance. But look, man, he's getting on the older side. He's a big boy. He's heavy-bodied. And at some point, that athleticism, it could fall off a cliff.
When does that happen? When does it fall off a cliff for Big Ben?
I don't know.
How does that look?
I mean, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be betting on it.
How does it look when a guy's falling off that proverbial cliff? Like, trying to think of quarterbacks.
Well, usually it's a slow death. You know, most of the time.
How was Joe Flacco last year?
That was a pretty quick death. It was dead before it got on the field. But most guys, you know, like when you're watching Peyton Manning over his last few years, you look at it and you're like, okay, there it is, there's that moment, and then all right, well, he's slowing off, he's falling down a little bit.
Do you think Peyton fell off Manning of the old? Do you think he did fall off a cliff his last year?
No, I will not say that he fell off a cliff because. I was just there. I was just in the huddle, and I know the way that the team just rallied behind him. I know the way that he was able to use his mind. Mm-hmm. At any time you could be that smart, you can last a lot longer because if you can be on the field and you're an offensive coordinator that's got a vantage point that nobody else has and you know how to make the adjustments of line of scrimmage and you've got to have the freedom to make those adjustments as well, you can get yourself in the right situation at the right time for sure. But – you know, if he would have kept going another couple of years, it probably would have looked even worse and worse, you know?
What else scares you on the Steelers?
What scares me?
Yeah, I think sometimes I'm starting to waver a little bit about this game, too, because Roethlisberger's older.
Watt scares me against our tackles.
Okay. All right.
Fantastic pass rusher. Absolutely fantastic. Let's see.
Yeah, but doesn't every team – hold on. Doesn't every team have a guy like that? Everybody's got somebody like – I mean, we should be filled with terror. The night is filled with terror with Garrett Bowles playing left tackle. Although, hold on.
The season is full of terror.
It's dark and filled with terror.
Oh my gosh, this is the most depressing book I've ever read. Every single chapter gets more and more scary.
But you said Bowles was getting better. Everybody said he was getting better. Well, you know what's funny? When everybody
I say that, and it is true. You know, physically, you look at the games, and as the season progressed, he got better and better. And you look at it physically, and you say, okay, you could win a lot of football games with what he's putting out there physically. But then you go back and you watch the film like we've been doing, and you realize, boy, in the Raiders game, he had a 15-yard penalty that took points off the board. Boy, you go back game by game, and not a single week goes by in which there's not some just extremely boneheaded play that affects the team in an extremely negative manner. So, you know, physically it has improved, but mentally it hasn't gotten anywhere.
See, every time I hear people criticize Bowles, it's always about the holding, more so than it's about, you know, poor play. Although I suppose the holding's part of the poor play, right? But
yeah, I mean, why does a guy hold, D-Mac? You know, he doesn't just go out there and hold. Yeah. He holds because he's in bad position. He holds because he opened up his hips, and he gave the guy a short corner, and he realizes, mm-hmm. boy, if I don't stick my arm around his neck, he's going to decapitate my quarterback. So, you know, the holding, it's all a part of physically not playing the game the way that you're supposed to play the game.
All right, TJ Watt, what else? What else about the Steelers game?
James Conner's a really good running back. Ben Roethlisberger's a fantastic QB.
We'll see. We don't know. Maybe he will be. Maybe he won't be.
Well, yeah, but I'm going to assume for now that he's going to come back and play at a high level, okay? Juju Smith-Schuster? Who else they got a wide receiver right now? Help me out here.
I don't know.
That's the only one I can think of.
That's my point. That's my point. To me, there's nothing really about the Steelers that just kind of leaps off the page and just says, look out for these guys.
All right, you want to change your pick?
Boy, I'm thinking about it. I am thinking about it.
It's the big board of predictions that we get to time stamp and date anytime we want to change it, and you've got the luxury of changing it anytime you want to.
But you made a good point about Drew Locke and, like, man.
That's a tall task for a young QB to walk into
right.
Heinz Field walk out with the W.
I'll stick with my prediction, I guess, on it. I just don't think this game is impossible to win for the Broncos. And I think people a lot of times just pick the Steelers because they're the Steelers.
Hey, maybe Mike Tomlin will get suspended by then.
Maybe
that envelope it was a letter to a love letter to James Harrison. Maybe that'll end up in a suspension.
Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it?
You know what? That one actually does intrigue me a little bit, D-Mac. Nobody is talking about there being any sort of consequences for it, and I understand why, because it's so far removed, and how the heck are you going to prove anything?
Yeah.
But why is that one not going to be an investigation? Like, that is a big deal. That's a huge deal.
Great question. I don't know. You got a player. See, this is the problem. James Harrison is looked at as a bit of a kook, kind of a wild card. But like I said before, Jose Canseco was looked at like that, and he wrote the book Juice, and everybody's like, Jose Canseco.
See, like,
everything he said was true.
Those guys is just like overly blunt and honest,
yeah,
right?
Everything,
you know,
was
like,
true.
Like they will just tell the stories that nobody else will tell, because mm-hmm. locker room etiquette says that that'll go to the grave.
Yeah.
But I don't like view those guys as just like liars, as fabricators,
yeah.
right?
What was in the envelope? What was in the envelope?
Probably $75K, because that's what the fine was.
Oh, man. I don't know, man. Maybe I think some guys just – Mike Tomlin is looked at, like, as a saint. He's just, like – he's just so highly regarded. Although
I'm just going to tell you, the players love Mike Tomlin because he lets them run loose. He lets them do their thing, and he kind of reminds me a little bit of Phil Jackson, to be honest with you. Like, Phil Jackson let those guys run amok. He let them do their deal because he just played a little bit of psychologist and let them get the breathing room that they needed at times. That's who Mike Tomlin is. You know, if guys don't come to an OTA practice, well, no big deal.
If they
need a couple days off, no big deal.
Right. I'll stay with my pick, but you know what? There's wiggle room there, and we'll see. I'll still count it as a loss, but it won't surprise me if they can pull that off. Steelers week here on The Fan. Okay, I'm looking forward to our final game. Looking at Pat Shurmur's offense, because Jeremiah Searles will join us. That's after 4:30. I can see the text line. Boy, a lot of people.
You know what? Here's a good one. Sorry, you're going to be mad at me because you're trying to tease out of this. But with the Steelers, does your prediction change if fans cannot be in the stands? That's from CJ in Boulder. That's a good question. That's a great question.
Well, let's talk about it. Let's talk about it on the other side. It's the Drive on the Fan.
Does your company make safety a top priority? Alliance Safety, Colorado's premier supplier of safety equipment, is here to help make it one. As an authorized distributor of 3M safety products and home to all pro gear, Alliance has a vast inventory of personal protective equipment designed to keep your workers safe, including fall protection, safety glasses, protective gloves, and gas detection solutions. Visit AllianceSafetyInc.net. Call 303-388-8766 or stop by the Alliance Safety Warehouse off I-70 and Tower today to lock up all your safety needs.
Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan presents Football at 4. It's Steelers Week. Breaking down the game between the Broncos and Steelers on this Think Big Thursday. Here's The Drive with Tyler Palumbis and D-Mac.
Hi, Tyler. What was that question you saw on the text line? I thought it was pretty interesting.
With the Steelers, would our predictions change at all if there are not fans in the stands? I think it's a good question.
That is a good question.
And my answer is yes. Yes. My answer is yes. I do think it impacts things. And the likelihood of there being fans is incredibly low. So, you know what? I'll factor it in. I'll think about it. I think we've both acknowledged this is a game that, we might be able to have some wiggle room in. The most intimidating part about going to Heinz Field is the terrible towels and that fan base. So certainly that impacts things.
I think that always impacts things with the Steelers. I think that's part of the issue playing the Steelers, even at home, because they do have a tremendous fan base and they show up for things. That is a fascinating question, man.
That is a fascinating question. Here's a good one. How many games on our schedule is this really going to be a factor in?
Oh, man.
Chiefs, it's a major factor.
Huge factor against
for
the
sure.
Chiefs, yeah. Let's see. Jets, no big deal. That place is a freaking cavern.
Yep.
That crowd doesn't even matter. Patriots, not a big deal, I don't think. Falcons, zero deal.
Oh, I think Patriots is a big deal. Yeah.
At Foxborough?
Dude, that's a tough place to play. Heck yeah.
All right.
When's the last time you went to a game there?
It's been a while. I'll take your word for it. You'd know better than I would, for sure. You're the one that told me Pittsburgh wasn't that big of a deal.
No, but I think it's a big deal for young players, for older players. Once you realize that, man, I can actually hear my quarterback and I can hear the snap count at the line of scrimmage, it all slows down for you. But young guys, you walk in there, you see those terrible towels.
Yeah,
it can make you do dumb things.
I've been to Metropolitan Stadium where the Jets were. Unfortunately, I was there for Super Bowl 48. The thing about that stadium is it's so big. Sometimes when you're playing in places that are so big, Tyler, it's actually less intimidating because everything. I've been in the Cowboys Stadium too. Kind of the same thing.
Well, please tell me about what's intimidating in these big places, D-Mac. Could you explain that for me?
Well, the not much. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I remember asking Stokely about
this. I'm
just
wondering how you came to this conclusion.
But I'd be being there, just seeing it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
All right, let's keep going. Falcons,
I'll tell you this.
Not a big deal.
A smaller place, like, listen, this is just a guess on my part. But I would guess that a smaller place like in Indianapolis, which is a smaller place, but everything is right on top of each other, and the fans are into it. I bet you, I'm guessing that's a tougher place to play than in New York. Where the stadium
well,
is
New York is different because there's nobody in it. I mean, if they would fill that stadium and it was actually loud,
right.
Of course it would be intimidating. Of course that would be loud.
Yeah, so at the Jets, the crowd, that's nothing. At the Patriots, okay, fine. So that's an advantage, not there. Falcons.
No big deal. Terrible fan base. Nobody shows up. It's an entirely empty stadium.
Yep. At the Raiders, no big deal. That'll be,
no big deal.
That would be a home game anyway.
Right.
There's not that many Raiders fans out there. Chiefs, big deal.
Big deal.
Huge
deal. Big time deal, for sure.
So that's an advantage.
Chargers, no big deal.
At Carolina, at Chargers. So where it's an advantage, maybe just the Chiefs and the Patriots.
Chiefs,
Steelers.
Patriots, and Steelers.
That's it.
Yeah.
But enough to win the game? Oh, man.
I think it helps. I really do. D-Mac, we might see some weird things happen this year. I'll never forget when we went down to Baylor when I was playing for CU, and this is back when Baylor was just dog trash. I mean, they were terrible.
Yeah.
And we go down there, and it was just the quietest environment I've ever seen. There was about 2,000 people in the stands.
Right.
You could hear every conversation that was going on behind you, and you just could not get up for the game. You just felt like a zombie. It was like, are we out here for a practice, or what's going on? And I would imagine, D-Mac, that's going to pop up a handful of times this year.
Well, you know they've talked about pumping in crowd noise.
Yeah. So, okay, I was a little bit confused on that. I'm a little bit confused on that, D-Mac. So, are they pumping in crowd noise just for the TV, or are they pumping in crowd noise in the actual stadium?
I think they're I know TV, but I could have sworn I heard some conversation about putting it in the stadium as well.
Okay.
Which would be odd, to say the least, right? Like, hey, quiet.
So you've got like semi-loud crowd noise when they're on offense, and you've got super loud crowd noise when – I mean, do we have a limit on the decibel level that we can put into this thing?
Just one dude up in a control room with a knob. You know?
I tell you what, Indianapolis, those people, they had no limit on their decibel level. They were piping in noise like you wouldn't believe.
They were. That's what they were supposedly doing.
Oh,
that's
they were, I promise you.
Yeah.
Hey, that was another eerie place to play, by the way. Oh, man. I remember when we went out there and we were playing Peyton Manning. I was going up against Dwight Freeney in Mathis. And, dude, you get on offense, and it is just deafening how loud it can be. You're in that dome, great fans. They're well-trained. And then they go on offense. And dude, you can hear a pin drop. You're like on the bench, and you're feeling a little bit guilty if you're having a conversation with your peer because you're like, I don't know if I can talk right now. You're in church.
You know, I'm seeing on ESPN, there's a conversation they're having. Ohio State athletic director says you might be able to see 20 to 50,000 fans in the stands. Now, that's 100,000 seat horseshoe there at in Columbus. But you know what, Tyler? I bet that happens. I bet they figure out a way by the fall to have a certain amount of fans in there. I bet the games aren't played in front of zero fans.
Oh, I don't know.
I thought
Governor Polis had a pretty good idea for Rockies games that maybe all professional teams could enact something like this. He wants at the very least to allow special privileges for military, for fire department, for people that deserve to be celebrated during these tough times. And I think he's being more in particular about people that are on the front lines of COVID-19. That's a good idea. Like what harm would you have in that? And getting people properly spaced out and rewarding a group of 500 people or 200 people. You know what I mean?
I agree. And I think you could actually raise those numbers. And I think you could have different entrances at different times for different groups of people. And, you know, hey, listen, it's 70,000 there at Mile High Stadium, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you got 20,000 in there, it's going to feel pretty empty. But you probably could put 20,000 in. You know, I you could have a luxury box, Tyler, with 10 people or less in there.
Sure.
You could be pretty wild to be actually in the stands, though, wouldn't it? And, you know, be socially distanced. And
well, bottom line, I mean, I just think it's a great idea. You've got an entirely empty stadium that if you keep it in a controlled environment, of course you could do something like that.
Yeah.
And of course it's a great idea. That would be a cool experience. Can you imagine? That's a reward for something you've been going through over the last 6 months, 8 months, to be able to be like one of the very few people that actually gets to witness a game.
It would be amazing, actually.
It's incredible.
It would be incredible.
You'd get firsthand access to all the players and conversations. You'd hear it all. That'd be awesome.
It would be awesome. We'll see. I think it's going to come together one way or the other. It's going to be surprising how probably quickly it does. I bet you the NFL doesn't skip a beat. I have no idea what college sports is going to be. Who knows? But I bet you they figure it out. Okay. Bill Polian, we'll hear from him in a little bit, Tyler, as he was on with the Zoeckley Show. He had some really interesting things to say about Pat Shurmur. But that being said, we're going to talk about Pat Shurmur for the final time in terms of Pat's playbook with special guest Colorado high school standout and Nebraska trader Jeremiah Searles, who played on that 2017 team. He'll join us next.
104.3 The Fan presents The Drive. Here's Tyler Columbus and D-Mac.
We welcome to the show, Jeremiah Searles, who was a star there at Bear Creek and University of Nebraska, and was a big member of the offensive line of the Minnesota Vikings in 2017. First of all, Jeremiah, good afternoon. Thanks for being on with us again.
Oh, absolutely. Excited to be back.
Well, good. Although, you know, we're at the end here. And what an incredible season you guys had until this fateful afternoon in Philadelphia.
Second down and six. This one floated for Rudolph. Touchdown. What a start. Just about a perfect drive put together by the Vikings. And what a good throw from Keenum there. Keenum throws. He's picked. Patrick Robinson back the other way. Robinson for the touchdown. And Foles able to get away and throw. Pass is caught. Jeffrey, touchdown. Foles launches downfield. Smith, touchdown.
They're a talented team, and they'll be back. But for tonight, it's the Philadelphia Eagles.
Tyler, I felt sad watching this. I am not joking. After watching every single game and seeing so much good stuff and being so optimistic about what Pat Shurmur could bring to Denver, Tyler, I felt that, and first I'll send it to you, Tyler, what your thoughts were, and then we can go to Jeremiah.
Well, you know, they come out the gates. Case Keenum throws a nice little touchdown there to Rudolph. You're thinking, okay, here we go. The miracle was for real. But, boy, did it just all go downhill from there. Case Keenum throws a really ugly pick six that really just started the downhill portion of it. And Jeremiah, you could speak to this much better than I can, but it just felt like you guys were a team that all season long, Case Keenum had never really been pressed. He hadn't really had to play from behind. You guys were able to run the ball all season long because you were playing with the lead. And then you put him in a situation where he was a little bit pressed, and it looked like you guys just were not comfortable playing from behind.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't our game plan all year. I mean, and that wasn't really what was our success was all year. If you look at games we struggled in early, especially against Pittsburgh, we fell behind quick and we struggled early on in the year there when Case took over. But, I mean, the big thing for us in that game was our defense didn't really create opportunities to score for us, which if you go back and look throughout the year, they did a really nice job at that. And, yeah, I mean, that game was just salt in the wound. And a lot of it had to do with, and I mean, you talk to anyone that was on that team, is we didn't have a very good week of practice. And Tyler, you know how that goes. You're going into the NFC Championship game, and I'm not going to lie to you, Wednesday, everyone was still really, really drained from Sunday.
Yep.
That was one of the most emotional things I've ever been a part of. And, I mean, it was like, man, NFC Championship week, let's go. But at the same time, like, our bodies were just very much like, emotionally, it took till like Thursday to get us going again. And Everyone felt it. We didn't really know what was going on. But, it's the theory. Everything that goes up must come down, right? We were on the biggest high of a high. And so, we didn't have a great week of practice, and that sucked. And we went out there, and we thought we could do our thing. And, that opening drive gave us a lot of confidence. But at the end of the day, in the NFC Championship game, you can't turn the ball over the way we did and get 3 points off the turnovers. And, expect to have long, flea flicker for a touchdown, I think, was in that game. And it's just one of those things where they couldn't do anything wrong, and by the end of the game, we couldn't do anything right.
That's, it's so funny to hear you say that, Jeremiah, because when I'm watching – I'm like, everything is a little bit off. Like, everything. Like, the defense doesn't normally play like that. Keenum usually doesn't underthrow a ball like that. A sack fumble. Like, I don't know if Keenum fumbled the ball all year, and they got a sack fumble for a turnover. It really did feel like is that what it felt like from the sideline? Like, what's going on here? I don't even recognize this team.
Yeah, a lot of it had to do with, the Eagles front was extremely good that year. They were an extremely talented front. They had first round picks across the board. They had an all pro Fletcher Cox and Brandon Graham and Tim Jernigan and Jason Long. All those guys were just studs across the board, and they thrived on getting ahead and pass rushing. That's what they wanted to do. And so we fell right into their game plan. Because our game plan was we can't allow them to do that. We got to run the football on these guys. We got to keep them honest. Because if they get to pin their ears back, there's just too many weapons that they have that they can get home without blitzing. And that's essentially what turned into that game plan. But, yeah, you nailed it. We were just every little thing. When you're in that elite level of a playoff, one play, one game away from the Super Bowl, if you're going against a team that's hitting on all cylinders and you're just a little bit off, it's really going to show.
Jeremiah, you guys are 13-3. Everything's going great. And when you're watching the broadcast of the final few games of the season, week after week, the announcers are just relaying these messages that your head coach had been relaying to them about Case Keenum. And, you know, at one point, apparently Zimmer said that Case Keenum was throwing, he was throwing horseshoes out there. He was just getting lucky. He wasn't really playing good football. He was just getting lucky. What was going on in, inside that building as there's discussions of Teddy Bridgewater, Sam Bradford, or is it going to be Case Keenum? When you guys are 13-3, that's a pretty wild conversation.
Yeah, I mean, we tried to keep out of it as much as we could. And I'll say this, Case was the first guy that he didn't care. He just wanted to play with the boys and he wanted to win football games. And I mean, he was having a, I mean, he'd always joke. I can't remember what the movie was. Man, I'm sorry, you're having the time of my life. And he joked around because he was. And all of us were. I mean, that whole season was just this magical ride of, man, it was fun to show up to work every day. It was fun to walk into work and know, man, we're going to win this week. Where I've been on teams where, I mean, the year before that, we were 8-8 in Minnesota, and the following year in Buffalo where we won 6 games. And those are when it's hard to come into work every day when you're like, man, I don't know if we're going to win this week, or man, we're going to get beat this week. And it's just, it's tough to be in part of those. But that was just one of those fun things that we just tried to avoid the noise, because it almost seems like the better we got, the more people rooted for us to fail. And it was just, I mean, I don't know if that's nature right now, I mean, the society we live in or what, but I mean, the way that the quarterback controversy played out there was, I mean, we have really one quarterback who was healthy. Sam was not healthy. And then you had Teddy, who was kind of healthy, but I mean, really on one leg still. And then we just rolling with Case, and Case embraced the underdog piece to him. And we all kind of rallied behind Case, defense included. And I think that's part of what made that team so special, is when, and how tight knit that group was, because Case is kind of the glue that held everyone together there.
By the way, I seriously was rooting for you guys and revisiting the whole thing. I know it's probably ancient history to you. But when they put in Mike Remmers at left guard for the first time in the playoffs, Jeremiah.
Clearly a terrible decision.
Oh, my God. I felt bad for you.
You're a big salt in the wound guy, aren't you there, D-Mac?
Well, I'm not trying to be mean. I'm telling you if I felt like that, I can't even imagine what you were going through when they put Remmers out there to play your position.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily thrilled about that whole, the way that all went down. It was kind of like, all right, I was told by multiple coaches I was too valuable to start because we didn't have anyone else that could back up. And I mean, that's not a fun pill to swallow, especially when you don't really believe half of it. So that was an ideal time. And, yeah, I mean, Remmers was like, I could play guard. I was like, what do you mean you could play? I played guard all year. But that was frustrating. I mean, Remmers ended up playing guard for them the next year, and, I mean, it didn't work out great for him. I love Mike, and he was the first to tell you, like, that's not my best position. And it wasn't fun, but, I mean, looking back on it, I was a team guy. I mean, Tyler knows how it is. You say yes, sir, and kind of swallow the Cheerios as you walk forward, and you just want to make you. Want to make the team year after year.
All right, but be honest. Be honest. I get it. You're being a good guy. But when he got a holding call on that touchdown run against the Saints and negated the touchdown run, tell me you weren't thinking, you got to be kidding me. I should be out there right now.
Yeah, I mean, I was that entire game, being honest. First the Saints game and the Eagles game, I was like, man, that should be me. That should be me. I should be out there doing this. I thought I earned it. I thought I deserved it, but for whatever reason, they decided to go a different direction. And, I mean, as I always say, that's above my pay grade.
All right. Hey, well, listen, one more here real quick. So, you know, the whole purpose of this exercise is to figure out what a Pat Shurmur offense is going to look like for the Denver Broncos. Yep. And, Jeremiah, I don't know how closely you followed Shurmur when he was with the Giants, but that offense was radically different. Right. I mean, it didn't look anything like what you guys were running in Minnesota. They were in shotgun all the time, just throwing the ball all over the place, no commitment to the running game whatsoever. And you guys are underneath center, very strong, old-school type of running game. Mm-hmm. Why do you think he looked so different with the Giants? And what do you think Broncos fans should really expect from Pat Shurmur?
Yeah, I think you can – I mean, I'll let you expand on this once we get here, but, I mean, you very much know that a lot of times there are certain players that know they have more power than the coach. And I think that Eli Manning was that for the first few years that Shurmur was there. I mean, you can come in as an offensive coordinator and even a head coach and say, hey, here's what we're going to do, and here's my system. And if you're Eli Manning, an arguable Hall of Fame Super Bowl winning coach, like, yeah, you know, I don't do that. I'm going to do something else. And a lot of times you don't really win that battle as a coach. Like, there's certain players that have that type of power. And I think that Eli Manning had that type of power. I think once Daniel threw the ball a ton, because it's really hard to shift your entire scheme mid-year. I think that if Shurmur gets his druthers and Shurmur gets what he wants to be a power football team that runs the football and then passes the ball effectively. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think he's still that old-school mindset that, all right, we got a young quarterback. And like I said the first time I chatted with you guys, he does a fantastic job of calling plays for his players. He's not so stubborn or pig-headed that, hey, this is my system, and no matter what, we're running this system. He's going to figure out, okay, what does Drew Lock do really well? What does Philip Lindsay do really well? What is this new running back we got to do really well? What's the receivers? What routes do they like to run? What concepts does Garrett Bowles and company like to run up front? We're going to run those. And so I think you're going to see whatever you see them being successful with in the preseason and even through training camp, whenever that might be, I think that's when you'll get to see this offense really flourish and thrive, because he's going to call plays that are good for them.
So overall, you're optimistic then?
I am. I'm very optimistic. Shurmur is an incredibly smart coach. I think he's a really, really talented coach. And I think that him being back to OC and not having to deal with all the BS that a head coach has to deal with is going to be really good for him.
By the way, last thing. The only thing Tyler and I could figure out by the criticism that was obviously coming from the coaches to Case Keenum through the broadcast was Case must have been terrible in practice. I don't even know how else to say it, because they had so many doubts. Was that the case with Case? Was he just awful in practice and really good that year during the games?
No. I mean, I thought Case was good in practice. I mean, to be honest with you, I can never remember us walking off the field like that was our best practice ever that entire year. We found ways to rally, and we found ways to do really good things. And, I mean, a lot of it was we'd do stuff on Wednesday that we'd be like, man, that wasn't a very good practice.
But so it sounds like he was terrible.
He was not terrible, but I mean, it was a lot of down the lines of like, okay, Case, or do you guys not like this concept? Like, no, we didn't like it. We didn't feel like it ran well during the practice. So it's like, all right, we throw it out and we go to something else you do like, which is, I mean, trial and error is a huge part of what practice is for. And I think sometimes people read into, oh, wow, he did not have a good practice according to, I mean, the media standards, or maybe a coach is just saying that. But I think a lot of it had to do with he's a backup quarterback, and, I mean, obviously they didn't want to sign him the next year, so I think they were trying to set the stage a little bit for that as well.
Was Sam Bradford close to being put into that championship game at all?
Not that I can recall. I was thinking okay. that as I was watching that, but, I mean, Sam was – he was so beat up, man. I mean, that poor guy, I don't think could stand up off the toilet at the end of the year with his wow. knee hurting the way it was, and it was just a weird gig, but – I don't think they were ever really – I mean, I think they knew Case got us to where we were going to be, and we were going to ride that ship through that.
All right. Hey, Jeremiah, thank you so much, man. We really
great stuff,
appreciate
buddy.
The time.
Yep.
Hey, absolutely, man. Go Big Red as always.
Oh. Yeah, go Buffs. Right on.
Thanks, Jeremiah. We'll talk
see.
To you.
See you, dude.
See you,
talk to you later. Well done.
He's optimistic, Tyler. Optimistic.
Yeah. You know, I don't know.
We're at a crossroads, aren't we?
We're at a crossroads.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I'll give you my thoughts on those.
Yeah. Let's hash it out. We'll have Nikki. We'll have plenty of time to talk it out. And, hey, there's some brilliant news for the Broncos from a national perspective. And so I'm guessing it comes from a guy who's not betting his mortgage every week. Details on that next.
It's The Drive on Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. Here's Tyler Palumbus and D-Mac.
We are joined by our great friend, Nikki Bala of The Athletic, brought to you by Perry's Pizza. And the last time we spoke to you, Nikki, apparently it was inspiration to get your dog out for a walk. How has that been going since the last time? How is Joey doing?
I mean, we go on a walk every day, mostly. He's, he's sleeping right now.
Okay. Well, if it's a walk, if you have to carry him, but okay.
I mean,
we'll go to the park later or something.
Yeah,
you know, he's trying, and he's not fat.
He's socially distancing.
Exactly.
Did you have to have a heart-to-heart conversation with Joey about the situation from your vet saying he was overweight?
No, I feel like he was shamed enough as it was, so I didn't want to rub it in. You know, okay. It's been a hard week for the little guy.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Because we did see photos. Of, I mean, it was like seconds after we were done talking with you a couple days ago, you were tweeting out pictures of you and Joey out there, or at least Joey.
Yeah, you know, we're trying. But again, he's not overweight. He's deboned. He's sick. He's, you know, he's... Poor guy. He's been shamed. He just walked out. He could hear us talking.
Worse. He's just publicly
I'm not,
shaming him.
Hey. I think he looks great. I'm fine right. with the way Joey... Oh, who am I? Who am I to judge? That's for sure. Nikki, so we saw on Instagram one of Lauren Landau's trainers, Augie, who both Tyler and I know, by the way.
Augie's great.
Have some workouts going on, I guess. What details mm-hmm. can you give us about that?
I don't have a ton of details because I wasn't there. You know, though I would assume some people would be stalkerish and creepy. Don't do that. That's
well,
not,
it was funny because of the
nice.
Photo, I could instantly tell where it was.
Yeah, well, you know, there's... I try not to give it away. But, yeah, no, he's been in Denver. He's been throwing with some of his receivers. He's been working with the trainers at Lando Performance just to get in shape. So he's been, you know, he's been around. He's been working out. And, you know, it looked like they have some morning workouts going on with a number of guys. There have been other Instagram posts with, you know, some of the linebackers and the defensive linemen. So Lando Performance is a facility owned by Lauren Landau, but they have other trainers who work with the Broncos player since he's, you know, not right. allowed to now that he works
Lauren's
for the Broncos.
Not allowed to actually work there.
Yeah.
That is
so,
an interesting little situation, though, and I don't think there's anything untoward or wrong with it, but that is kind of unique, I suppose. I mean,
Lauren could pretty much, you know, he could govern the workouts that the guys are going through at his own facility, even though he can't be coaching there directly, right?
Well, he's not supposed to be involved at all. But it's great for the players because they know it's all going to be seamless and they know there's always going to be a place where they can train and, you know, the guys are trusted and, you know, but, you know, he's supposed to, and he does. He's supposed to be removed from the situation because he works for the Broncos. It would be.
Yeah. He began as an athlete. He was training with me and then, you know, probably for the last 4 or 5 years of my career, he was working beside Lauren Landau, and then he took over the building more or less once Lauren went to the Broncos.
Yeah, he's the lead guy there. So, I mean, it's like getting a second Lauren, even though he's not, you know. So it's great for the players when you think about it.
Yeah. Hey, I see on your Twitter account that you had a conversation with Mayor Hancock. What'd you learn about pro sports coming back?
Yeah, I'm just making the rounds to local officials. He thinks the NFL season is going to start on time. I mean, like most people, I think at this point, he doesn't envision fans being allowed in, at least not at first. Maybe they kind of slowly start to phase them in. But, you know, right now it's still a long shot to see a full stadium at Mile High. Let's see what else. You know he's a big Broncos fan, so we talked a bit about their offseason moves and some of the things he's excited about. What else? He echoed a lot of the same things that Governor Polis did, just in terms of wanting sports to return, but, you know, when the leagues are ready and they have set protocols in place and, you know, obviously the players in the league all have to agree on these things, which it sounds like with baseball they're still pretty far apart on that. But, you know, he seems to think that, you know, the NFL and a lot of the other leagues are going to kind of be watching what MLB does to see how it goes and, you know, if they need to make any adjustments from there. I also asked him about, you know, what kind of economic impact would having no fans have on the city of Denver? I mean, the Broncos are...
Yeah.
They drive a lot of business for the city, and I think with the loss of, you know, conventions in Denver plus the Broncos, that's a major hit for the city. So
what do you say?
He certainly is expecting it. They're kind of planning under the assumption that there will be no fans at the very least, and that's going to, you know, you don't get the tax benefits there, right? When people come in from out of town, you don't get, you know, the hotels, restaurants, you think about the number of ways people spend when they go to Broncos games. So there's a big loss there and stadium revenue too. So it's a concern, but he said right now the focus still is on, you know, the health of those in the city, and then they'll really turn their focus to the economy and building it back up. So I'm not sure how much you can do to, you can't really prevent it, how much you can do to recoup the costs. I'm not sure, but I guess I'll try.
We see some proposed rule changes going through. Of course, the 4th and 15th thing is something the Broncos brought up a couple of years ago, something we've been talking about literally for years. Do you feel a swing in momentum on that one, or how the rest of these other proposed rule changes are going to go?
Yeah, they said there was a swing in momentum last year when they proposed it, and it didn't go through. This one is slightly different, though. I think the Broncos proposed to try to retain possession after score in only the fourth quarter. Each team would have one chance to line up at their own 35 and essentially try to convert a 4th and 15. If they're successful, obviously they retain the ball. If not, they turn it over. This one is each team would have a maximum of 2 tries to start at their own 25 and after a score and try to get a 4th and 15 at any point in the game. So it's slightly different. I mean, from all the reports I've read, you know, from the national writers, it seems like there's some momentum, but we'll see. I think of the proposals that were submitted this year, it probably has the best chance of passing. The other ones were the addition of a sky judge and a technology supervisor. And it sounds like there wasn't much momentum there because the competition committee kind of poo-pooed it, but they might experiment with it in preseason if there is preseason. And then I think a lot of the other rules were focused on eliminating clock manipulation late in games.
Yeah, saw those, yep.
So, yeah, those are the major ones.
All right, Nick.
Hey, before you go, tell me about Peyton Manning's new bourbon that is so expensive. Yeah. Only Peyton Manning can afford.
Yeah, he's got new booze. Yeah. I mean, it sounds legit. It's like 102 proof or something.
What?
It's a pretty interesting story behind it, though, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's a golf course. I don't know where it is. I have to go back and read it. But there's a golf course, and there's really no club. It's really no amenities except for the shed. And whenever, you know, a lot of these people want to go golf there, but they would take a shot and they would leave the half-used liquor bottles for the next people. So they decided to make their own bourbon. It's really interesting. But it's $200 a bottle, which is slightly out of my price range. So I should not be trying it. Yeah,
$200 a bottle.
D-Mac could afford it, though. D-Mac, why don't you get one and let the rest of us try it?
You got to be kidding me.
Come on, man.
I'll pass on that.
Come on.
Have you heard how many endorsements he has? He's doing okay.
I need to put myself out there for a walk. I don't need to be going with the $200 bourbon.
I think there's only a limited number that they're going to make, too.
Okay.
So. Yeah, I mean, this is the good stuff.
All right.
Good to know. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Nikki.
Well, thank you, Nikki.
Tell Joey we said hi.
I will.
It's Nikki Javala, The Athletic, brought to you by Perry's Pizza. It's just after 5 o'clock. KKFN, KKFN HD1, Longmont, Denver. Bourbon music?
I mean, all country is about whiskey in particular. So, you know, a little slight variation on bourbon. You got to find that one.
Can I ask you a stupid question?
Oh, please. Keep
the music going there, Kevin. What's the difference between whiskey and bourbon?
Just the region. It's where it's made. It's like wine. It's just about the location where it's made.
But it's really the same thing?
As far as I understand, more or less.
I swear to God, I wouldn't know what.
Bourbon is made in Kentucky, and Scotch. Let's see, Scotch is from Scotland, I would imagine. Huh? How'd I do on that one?
I don't know.
I think I did well. I really think I did well there.
Does it have anything to do with the barrel or the fermentation process?
Well, now you're getting into technicalities that I don't know anything about, but I do know that it has to do with the region in which the liquor was born.
Okay. Like champagne can only be champagne if it's from a specific region in France, right? Something like that?
Yes, correct. That's exactly right. Now, whiskey, I believe, is like more generic. It's like all over America, you know, right. or Canada. Or I guess it's like, I don't know, the poor man's bourbon.
Yeah. Like, Coors Light can only be from Golden, Colorado. I mean, that's it.
Well, you got to tap the Rockies, D-Mac.
That's right. All right, trivia question. The mountain on the Coors Light bottles. What mountain is that?
Oh, I don't know. Mount Evans?
No.
Well,
that's a good little trivia. It's a Colorado 14er.
Is it like a 14er that is a little off the map or something?
Kind of.
All right, well, then it sounds like I have no clue. Bierstadt? I don't know.
Should I leave it out there for the old texters to win absolutely nothing?
Sure. They can get a virtual high five from us.
A virtual high five? All right, I'll go through the text line here real quick. Have you ever wondered that? Like, what is that mountain? Like, on the Coors Light cans?
Apparently, I'm way wrong, according to the text line, and people are really upset about it.
About
the bourbon stuff.
Yeah, you sound ridiculous.
No, I swear that there's something behind that. Bourbon is from Kentucky. I know that.
It can only be from Kentucky?
Don't know. Yeah.
That's what you said.
Well, you know what, D-Mac? I mean, listen, only believe 50% of what I ever tell you.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Long's Peak. It is not Long's Peak. A whiskey
Pike's
has
Peak?
What's? No, it's not Pike's Peak. Pike's Peak is not a very. Pike's Peak is kind of this big round mound. It doesn't have very dramatic features to Pike's Peak. Maroon Bells. It is not Maroon Bells. I would say a lot of people would think that. I mean, I get it, but it's not. Not Maroon Bells. Mm-mm. Bourbon has.
Have you hiked it?
I have not. I'm dying to do it. It's
how many 14ers have you done?
30.
30? Wow, good for you, man. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I had my time. I had my time.
I'm actually embarrassed to say I've never done a 14er.
What?
It honestly is on my list this summer. I want to do it really bad.
Never?
Never.
Not even when you're like a teenager with your folks or your brother or nothing, huh?
No, not a single time.
Wow.
You know, Big O had his hikes with Big O. Maybe I'll try to get him to orchestrate a 14er for us.
I'm seeing some people are getting it. It's Wilson Peak. Or
Wilson Peak. Never even heard of it. Where is that?
It's in Crested Butte. Or not, yeah. Telluride. It's in the Telluride area. In fact, there's two Wilsons. I think it's Mount Wilson and Wilson's Peak. But that's what it is. That's what it is down in Telluride. There you go, texters. It's Mount Everest. No, it's not Mount Everest. It's Coors Light,
Mount Everest.
Man.
Is that in Colorado?
No. That's in Tibet.
Kilimanjaro?
That's in Africa.
Oh, wrong continent.
Wilson Peak. Look, a lot of people are getting it. Rick from Pueblo. We got dozens of people getting it now. That's awesome. I do believe there's two Wilsons down there. It's Wilson Peak and Mount Wilson. And I believe it's Wilson Peak.
So, like, scale of 1 to 10,
yeah.
How challenging is a 14er for a relatively active, normal adult?
Oh, there's the vast majority of 14ers here in the state are nothing more than a very, very, very aerobic day out. If you can be on your feet and you're in aerobic shape for a good 6 to 8 hours, you can do most of the 14ers in the state.
So
then there's
have you done
diet.
The incline? Have you done the incline, D-Mac?
I have done the incline. Yeah.
Okay. I would imagine that is actually more physically exhausting in a shorter amount of time than doing a 14er. Am I correct?
A good
there?
Question. The incline, if you want to hike Pike's Peak, or you know, Pike's Peak's a great example. It's basically a trail, an easy trail all the way to the top, but it's you know 13.5 miles. Here's a little trivia for you. There's actually a mountain ahead in front of Pike's Peak. So you have to climb a mountain, then you go down and even a little bit, and then you ascend Pike's Peak. And halfway there, there's this place called Bar Camp. Bar Camp is awesome. It's a bunch of A-frames. There's actually a store maintained by two people who live permanently there. The Cog Railroad stops nearby, so you can get off and go to Bar Camp. Or you can climb the incline, and that cuts off a significant amount of switchbacks that would take you to climb that top mountain. Once you get to Bar Camp, now you're really climbing Pike's Peak, and that's another, you know, 7 miles straight up the hill to a donut shop.
Okay, so this sounds like something I should be able to do very easily.
Pike's Peak is, well, oh, man, I don't know. It's a long day. It's a brutally long day. You can always camp at Bar Camp if you wanted to. That's not the one I would try first, though, dude. I mean, that's like 26 miles of of hiking. I would just do, you know, oh gosh, there's so many easy ones. Bierstadt's a great one just to start. You go up to Guanella Pass.
It's, I mean, how is that not the mountain that Coors Light used? How is that not the mountain?
Well, because it's just not very
Coors,
dramatic.
I should say. Sorry.
It's James Marilat's with us. Hi, James. How are you, pal?
Hi, James.
I'm good, fellas. How are you?
How many 14ers have you done?
I've driven to the top of Pikes Peak.
Boy, that's it, huh?
Yep.
You've not climbed any.
No. And it's not that I'm anti-hiking. I mean, you know, I'm not Nick Ferguson. I don't think I'm going to get attacked by a mountain lion or something. But I just haven't done them. But I'm interested in this conversation. You're saying the ones that are like, you know, kind of doable out of the gate. I'm taking mental notes here. Bierstadt. That's going to be first on the list.
The easiest ones to do are Grays and Torrey. And there's a saddle between the two. They're just outside of Idaho Springs for the trailhead, which is the closest by far. It is class one climbing, meaning it's you could do it in a good pair of sneakers and some water. You really could do it.
James, do you know the difference between bourbon and whiskey?
I do.
Well, educate me.
Well, and this is because I went to the Kentucky Derby a couple years ago, and you know, on the way there, we stopped at some distilleries. So to be bourbon, it has to be at least 51% corn. You know, it can be rye or wheat or whatever else for the other grain, but at least 51% corn. And it has to be aged in a new charred oak barrel. Those are the two things.
I knew there was something. There was something to how you do it.
No, I'm pretty sure it just has to do with Kentucky. Well, it's just Kentucky.
Like 90 to 95% of bourbon is made in Kentucky, but technically it doesn't have to be from Kentucky. But whiskey can be made with any combination of corn in any grain, essentially. But to be bourbon, it has to be 51%, and it has to be a new charred oak barrel. Those are your two requirements.
So is bourbon sweeter?
Probably, yeah, typically. You know, because a lot of times whiskey's made in old barrels, and so then you'll get some of the stuff from previous, you know, previous things that were made in that barrel, whether it was wine, whether it was other whiskey, whatever. So yeah, it tends to be sweeter because it's getting it from the corn and from the oak.
Okay, thank you. I feel smarter.
How do you know all this?
I paid attention at the Maker's Mark tour. I was tuned in. It wasn't just all about the, you know, free drinks. I was
something
there to
D-Mac
learn
does
something.
Not do when you're speaking, James. He does not pay attention.
Yeah. Was there an explanation earlier? Did I really seriously have missed that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's terrible. Sorry about that. I was thinking about what James has on Timeline 25, really. That's really where my head is at.
Of course. Sure.
You know,
sure,
what,
yeah.
What year are we on, James? What's cooking?
I did 2000 today.
2000?
That was when Mike Anderson, a 27-year-old rookie who had spent 4 years in the Marines before he went to Utah, came to the Broncos. He filled in for Terrell Davis. Really only played 13 games a year. He had no carries in the opener. Missed basically two games in the middle of the season, rushed for like 1,487 yards, 15 touchdowns. Broncos won 7 of 8 down the stretch, got to 11-5, got in the playoffs with Gus Frerotte and Brian Greasy playing quarterback. So they had this transition year, right? Those were their quarterbacks. Shannon Sharp was gone. TD was hurt. It was Gus Frerotte, Brian Greasy, Mike Anderson, and then both Rod Smith and Ed McCaffrey had huge years. They got into the playoffs. So that was big. There was the Nuggets kind of falling apart when they had to trade Ron Mercer. Ron Mercer and George McLeod got into a fist fight after a game when the Nuggets met Orlando after the trade. I mean, all sorts of dramatic stuff. It was a tumultuous year, 2000.
And that was when the Avs, they got Bork. They got Bork late in the season, right?
Yep.
And then they lost to Dallas.
Second straight year they lost to Dallas in 7. Now it was like March. It was, you know, getting close to the end of the year, and they were basically a 500 team. They make the trade for Bork, go 12-2-1 down the stretch. They're red hot. They beat Detroit in the second round of the playoffs in 5, Phoenix in the first round. So Phoenix in the first round, 5, Detroit in 5. They get to Dallas. They lose a heartbreaker in overtime in game 5. Win game 6 to force game 7, but for the second straight year, they lose in Dallas in game 7 of the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, people might forget that Bork was actually here for a part of a season and then the entire season. He wasn't here just for one season. There was an off season where Ray Bork was on the team.
Long enough to get his name in the stands.
There you go, rafters. Yep.
No.
Yeah. How do you feel about that, James?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things of, look, he was an important part of that second Stanley Cup team. But when you're in this city for 14 months, There's no way. He didn't even play 100 games as an Av. I mean, if you count playoffs, he did, but 100 regular season games? You can't be in the rafters if you didn't play 100 games for a hockey team or a basketball team.
That
or
doesn't feel right, does it? No, no, that really does not feel right.
No, and it, and if memory serves, he was the, because Sakic and Forsberg and Waugh were still playing, so he was the first number to go up there for the Avs.
And you know what's amazing about that is I could see a franchise that has had no success and they hardly have any names to celebrate.
Yep.
And if he were to come to their team, they put him up there in the rafters after a season. I could understand that, but oh my gosh, the Avalanche has got all kinds of
names.
Hold
on, guys. How many times have the Avs won the Stanley Cup championship since that year? Since 2001? How many times?
I can't count.
It'd be a big
can you get
say.
Above zero?
All right, so what's to say that the most important players shouldn't be recognized for the contributions they had on the best teams?
Well, you guys answered that for me, D-Mac. Was he one of the most important players of that team?
Yes, for sure. Absolutely. Okay.
Sure, but
James, it'd be like
putting Neil Smith in the Broncos Ring of Fame.
Why not? Well, we just talked about that. They didn't have Neil Smith before the Jacksonville game. They get Neil Smith, they win two Super Bowls.
Sure, but he wasn't here long enough to be up there and enshrined and part of the legacy of in that way of the organization. It just doesn't feel right. You got to be
John Lynch here long enough.
No, John Lynch is another one that shouldn't be up there. Like that's the most laughable one. And no disrespect to John, but he was making Pro Bowls when he was here based on his name and his reputation. You know, he had the one hit on Drew Brees in San Diego that forced Drew Brees out of the division, made him become a free agent. But other than that, I can't think of another play he made in 4 years as a Bronco other than 15-yard ill-timed penalties. For him to be in the Ring of Fame is just laughable. That one's the biggest joke of all.
That's a tough one right there. Because
why is Eddie Mack not in the Ring of Fame?
Ah, there you go. Just getting to that. Yes,
that's a good question. Al Wilson isn't there. Trevor Price isn't there. Ed McCaffrey isn't there. There's a lot of guys who belong in the Ring of Fame much more than John Lynch. And, you know, he was fine when he was here, but it's not the Ring of Fine. He belongs in the Tampa Bay Ring of Fame, sure. But, yeah, there's a lot of guys. And you're right, Tyler. Ed McCaffrey's high on that list of guys who belong up there that aren't there. You know, there's political pieces to it. I mean, it took Rick Upchurch 2 decades to get enshrined, and he belonged there. It's not like he did anything during those 20 years more on the field to deserve it. So there's some politics at play there. I don't know what it is with Ed McCaffrey. As far as I know, he gets along with the team fine. I mean, he was working on their broadcasts for a few years, so, and that wasn't that long ago. But I don't know. I'm not sure why he's not up there, but he should be.
The crazy thing with Ed, there was a year they didn't put anybody in. Remember that?
Yep.
Nobody went in. And I'm like, wow, nobody is more appropriate than Ed at this point. And by the way, so, why isn't Trevor Price in? Why he was unbelievable, and they won Super Bowls with him.
Al Wilson went to five Pro Bowls, and he's not there. There's nobody else in the history of the organization that's gone to more Pro Bowls and isn't in the Ring of Fame.
So, D-Mac, let me ask you this. Yeah. If you're not concerned about the length of time that somebody is here, what about DeMarcus Ware?
Put him in. They do not.
No.
Well, oh, but all right, you tell me. See, you weren't here for 48, though. I'm just telling you, it was different for you guys in 50 than 48. And where
I mean, you also want to put in the entire 50 team. Last time we went over this, you had about 12 players.
I would put in every significant player from that 50 team. I would, yes. You just do not win.
I can't wait till I go in the Ring of Fame. This is going to be awesome.
Well,
and it being significant on those teams, like, yeah, I'm with you. Like that we all can identify who those guys are. But to me, the Ring of Fame or having your number retired and put into the rafters, like, that's for guys who, you know, spent years and years and years there. It was the blood, sweat, and tears. It was the good and the bad.
Should you put Aqib Talib in there?
No.
Yes, of course you should.
No, he was
T.J. Ward.
All right, hold on. All right, so let's do this, James. Let's go through Super Bowl 50. Let's go through Super Bowl 50. All right. On offense, Peyton Manning, he's in, right?
Yes.
Okay. You think he's the best quarterback in franchise history, right?
He's the best player to ever wear the orange and blue. That's correct.
Wow. Okay. DT.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Best receiver in franchise history.
Emmanuel.
Whoa.
Yes.
Over Rod.
Yes. Rod is number two. DT is number one. Rod Smith was not going to catch a bubble screen and take it 80 yards. DT had a skill set unlike any receiver. Brandon Marshall had the same kind of skills. Courtland Sutton has the same kind of skill set, but DT did it for a long period of time. He was a better receiver than Rod Smith. Rod's number two. Everybody gets all upset about these things. It's like me saying Todd Helton's the third best player in franchise history. Like, that's,
yeah, that's
something
a tough
insult.
One.
Let's keep going through. We all agree on DT.
Fine. Yeah, Sanders. DT, Emmanuel Sanders.
No.
Okay, I would agree. Anybody else on offense? Probably not. Well, Ryan Clady was technically on that team. He's a Ring of Famer, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. He was on the 48 team.
He was hurt on that team, too.
Yep.
Okay, so that's it on offense, right?
Ryan Clady's anybody? A lot more complicated than...
Oh, stop it. He's not even remotely complicated.
He was hurt in both Super Bowls. He
who
wasn't
cares?
A part of either
who
one
cares
of them.
If he was hurt in both Super Bowls?
I'm just saying, man.
Oh, D-Mac, you're out
just
of your
saying.
Mind. Right?
He wasn't part of those teams.
Deep breath. I'm moving forward.
I'm not saying he wasn't a great player, but...
I'm going to ignore this. I'm moving forward.
All right, keep going.
Okay, nobody else on offense, right?
No. Matt Paradis.
No. No, I love my man. I love my man, Matt, but he's not a Ring of Famer. Give me a break.
All right, I agree with you there.
All right, defense. Now this is where it gets pretty interesting. Chris Harrison, right?
Yes.
Okay. Akeem Tlaib, you said
Akeem
no
Akeem Tlaib's in.
Chris Harris was here for what, nine years?
How many years was Akeem here?
Akeem is borderline. If he goes in, I'm not going to be upset, and you know it's not going to be something I'm going to be talking about for years like I am with John Lynch, because there's a better argument to be made for him. So I'd be fine with that.
The problem is there's just so many guys that are worthy of it from this year's team. So I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't make it in the Ring of Fame. Derek Wolfe.
No, not even close.
What?
Wow.
No, he went to a grand total of zero, and I know it's not the be-all, end-all, zero Pro Bowls. Like, come on, he was here for 8 years, but he's not even close to being a Ring of Fame.
Oh, my gosh.
If Derek Wolfe goes in over Trevor Price, Derek Wolfe isn't half the player Trevor
Price
was.
Okay, well, when you put it that way, I think you've got a point. I do think you've got a point. Trevor Price should be going in before Derek Wolfe, but Derek Wolfe is a Ring of Famer in my mind.
No, but based on what, though? Just because he was here for a long time?
Yes. And he was a starter. He played a ton in those championship moments.
You know, when I was on a couple weeks ago, we were talking about, gosh, I'm already blanking on the running back who just signed with the Raiders. And we're like, how was he on the team for all those years and didn't do anything? Why am I blanking on the
Devontae
back?
Booker?
Yes. Derek Wolfe is just the defensive version of Devontae.
Oh, my gosh. That is the most asinine thing I've heard this entire year. I cannot believe you just said that.
Last year, he had he had his career year with, what, six sacks? I mean, give me a break.
First off, I think it was seven or eight. And second off, he had five or six sacks every single season he played.
No, he had a lot of twos and threes.
Oh,
my gosh. Now I got to look it up. Now I got to look it up.
What about Malik Jackson?
No, he if he'd have stayed around, he could have been.
He's pretty good.
John Elway made the wrong pick there. He made the wrong pick at middle linebacker, too. He had Derek Wolfe or Malik Jackson. He went Derek Wolfe, should have gone Malik Jackson. Danny Trevathan, Brandon Marshall should have gone Danny Trevathan. But, you know, Malik Jackson was a key part of that team. That's a prime example of it. Like, I don't know that they win it without him. But is he a Ring of Famer? No, not even close.
All right, I got to go through this. I just got to tell you. So 2012 is rookie season. Derek Wolfe, six sacks. 2013, four sacks. 2014, 1.5. 2015, 5.5. 2016, 5.5. 2017, 2. 2018, 1.5. 2019, 7. He had 33 sacks playing at the defensive end position in a scheme in which defensive ends do not get sacks. Come on, James.
Okay,
give me a break.
Look up Trevor Price. He was a lot less seasons and probably had 15
I'm not
to
fighting you on Trevor.
Sacks.
I'm not fighting you on Trevor. Not
so, it's just, you know, 33 sacks in 8 years. He's averaging a little over four a year. He had 2 years with 1.5 and one with two. Look, and it always comes across like I'm ripping the guy, and I'm not. He was a good player. But it's, again, like I say, it's not the ring of good. You got to be a great, great player. And if you were a great player in 8 years, you would have made at least one Pro Bowl. Heck, with as many people as that duck out every year, it's. I think it's even more telling that he didn't.
See, the problem is John Lynch. It really is. And this is nothing against John, who we all love. But no championships. I don't know. He probably did make a Pro Bowl, I suppose, in his time with the Broncos. But he was getting those like free Pro Bowl passes.
Yeah,
you know, how they just hand those out. John's a problem because I don't know how you put it. It's the same example. How do you put John in and not boom, 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 boom? You know, frankly, how do you put John in and not Derek Wolfe, to be honest with you?
And the problem that you're going to run into with a guy like Aqib Talib is if you put in Aqib, do you put in Darian Stewart? Do you put in T.J. Ward? Is it the entire no-fly zone? Like,
right.
Kind of where do you draw the line with that? Like, Chris is the easy one because he was here double the time as all those guys. He was here 8 years, 9 years. He's an easy one, but Aqib is right on the fringe to me. Yeah, but the only guy for sure on that defense, honestly, is Vaughn. He's the only sure, which sounds crazy because they won a Super Bowl based on that defense, but he's the only
you're telling me Chris Harris isn't for sure?
What's that?
You're saying Chris Harris isn't for sure?
Oh, no, sorry. So Chris Harris, too. So there's two. Chris and Vaughn. Those are your two.
One last one. Brandon McManus.
No, but,
was
you know,
perfect.
He could be.
Was
he could.
Perfect in the playoff run through the Super Bowl.
He was
perfect.
Arguably our MVP of the playoffs.
Has played, how many years is BMAC going to be here, so, including next year? What are we talking, 8, 9?
I think he has to stick around a while longer, and he needs to threaten Jason Elam's record for career points as a Bronco. I think he needs to be in that realm.
How far away is
he? What if he sets the all-time record for longest field goal?
That'll help for sure, but he'll be the third Broncos kicker to do it. Elam did it, Prater did it. I mean, right now I think McManus is just ahead of Prater, but barely. I mean,
by the way, he's going into his seventh season with the Broncos.
Seventh year. I don't know how many Pro Bowls Brandon's in, but in that Super Bowl year, he was perfect. I mean, he hit some huge kicks that year.
He did, but I also think at some point in your career, people had to say, boy, he's the best guy at his position. At some point, they had to. They've said that about Vaughn. They've said, DT would be in that conversation.
Oh, Brandon's in that conversation for sure.
Yeah, he's right there. He's right there.
That's a tricky one because he's kicking in the same time that Justin Tucker lives and breathes and walks the earth, which is difficult to be better than that dude. So, but for his time, man, he was great when he needed to be great. And he's been great for years.
I have a, probably too strict of standards when it comes to the Ring of Fame. I mean, half the guys that are up there, I would wipe out if I bought the team. Like, they don't belong up there. So, I don't mean it as any disrespect to Brandon McManus or anybody else I've said no to. I just think it's got to be something where it's like, man, you were an integral part of this franchise for years and years and years. You can't write the history of the Broncos without him. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there are very few players that live up to that standard.
Okay, since you're on a hating roll right now, James, you got to tell me about your Todd Helton tweet. You got to tell me about that one.
Yeah. So it was a tweet going out there about most overrated athletes in Colorado sports history, and almost everybody says Todd Helton is the best Rocky of all time. He's number one. I don't think he is. I think he's third. I think Larry Walker's the best. Nolan Arenado's two, soon to be one. And Helton is three. So by definition, if somebody says you're number one and you're actually number three, you're overrated. I don't think that's a knock. I don't think that's, ripping the guy.
That sounds harsh.
But, man.
You were a little bit more aggressive in your tweet, though. You said he did nothing but be average his entire career.
No. I didn't.
What did you say? Read it to me.
In his last 8 years, when he made $126 million, he won no gold gloves and went to no all-star games. If any other athlete in Denver went that long being basically mediocre, they would get run out of town on a rail, and Todd just gets a free pass. That's why I call him Teflon Todd.
Wow.
I mean, just nobody's on him. Now, his first 9 years, he was really, really good.
This is what I struggle with Todd, too, because in his last 5 years, I don't think he could have started at first base for any team in Major League Baseball.
No way. Is that real?
Yeah,
for real?
That is real, unfortunately.
He had like 3 years where he hit less than 10 home runs, no years where he hit more than 20 in those last 8 years, playing a power position.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't working, and so it was a free pass. So, people just don't take into account those 8 years when he was, basically a guy playing first base that was hitting, slap singles to the opposite field.
Oh, man, that's so hard. All right, we got to roll, James. This is why we love you, though.
This is great stuff.
We go in a totally different direction, but it's always interesting to talk about.
You're a man.
And follow Timeline 25 at 1043thefan.com. Thank you.
Appreciate it, guys.
Appreciate it.
You're pretty dumb, but you are the man.
The Fan Film Room. There's some really, really good news. And some slightly bad news with Albert
Okwuegbunam.
I got it. Okwuegbunam. That's next.
Columns and videos delivered to your inbox every morning. Register for the free Denver Sports Daily at 1043thefan.com.